by the dependents of the deceased from 6 months to 18 months. And we have considered that precisely because of the traditions that in certain instances we find that those who are supposed to be beneficiaries, they can't claim within a certain period of time based on our traditional beliefs. And therefore that is why we are extending that from 6 months to 18 months. But also, we have decided that we need to amend it to improve the maternity benefits. And if you recall, some of the contributors joined later in the unemployment insurance, and by then they were not benefiting from the maternity, particularly the domestic workers. And also, we have decided that we need to increase the benefits for the contributors based on the portfolio that we have as the unemployment insurance fund, and also to make provisions for financing of unemployment so that we can retrain them in order for those workers who are retrained to re-enter the labor market. And some of the proposals are administrative, of which I believe that the officials will be able to take through the members of the portfolio committee on those issues. But I must say, Chairperson, during the process at NEDLAC, there was a proposal by organized labor, because in terms of the current legislation, unemployment insurance, only those who have been retrenched or who are sick, who qualify to claim from the insurance. And therefore, there was a proposal by organized labor to say, shouldn't we include those who resign at work? And unfortunately, we said, let us look at that probably in future, because what we have done, we already requested those who had done the investigation for us whether the fund can afford that. But at the current moment, we said we can't afford that one. And it was agreed, therefore, that probably when we review the portfolio, then we need to consider probably even those who resigned at work. So those are the few issues here that I just want to highlight at the present moment. And as I have requested from you, Chair, that if I can be excused so that I can go back to the meeting, because there are also issues that will be affecting us as the Department of Labor, to go back to the Economic Cluster Cabinet Committee. But also the officials are going to be here to go through on some of the questions that will relate for further clarity. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
And thank you very much, Minister, for honoring the invitation to tell us about the bill to be amended. Members, anything that you want to raise to the Minister from what she has said, remember that the department will be going into details in terms of unpacking the amendment. But it is important, it was important that an executive authority of the department, if we are to do an amendment, at least for her to come and introduce to us. Honourable Bafrain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Thank you, Honourable Minister, for coming to the meeting this morning. We appreciate that. I did want to raise one point, but before I do that, I want to overall, we are strong supporters of the amendments to the bill, and we thank you for that, because it's come timely. People are desperate for help, and I think the department has come to their help in this EIF legislation. The one point I did want to target is what you spoke about last, was the resignation, and people wanting to access the fund after that resigned. My whole idea about the philosophy of the fund is to help people who find themselves in bad circumstances beyond their control. I think that's the idea, that's the philosophy behind the fund itself, is to help people out. It's almost an insurance that they are accessing because something's happened to them that they didn't control. Now, we understand that resignation is normally within your control. There is the concept of a constructive dismissal, where there's a resignation where you get forced out beyond your control, and then you could change that. And the department has already covered for the constructive dismissal. So I would strongly advise against revisiting the resignation issue, but that's obviously a debate for another day. But thank you, Minister.
There is no other sentence. Do you want to say something before you leave for your next meeting?
Thank you very much. I think the member has already indicated that is the debate for another day. Since even Nedlec has said, let's allow the process to go through, but in future we have to review when we think that we can afford, particularly when we review the UIF portfolio, whether it can afford to cover those who resigned as well. So I think we have agreed that after 18 months or 24 months, then that's when we have to review the portfolio so that we can see whether we can accommodate everybody. Thank you very much, Chair.
The Minister has introduced the bill. The details of the amendments are going to be tabled by the department. And the questions were only on what he has presented. But I will just give you and hear what is that you are going to say.
Chairperson, thank you. My apologies for being late. I lost my key this morning and I couldn't get out of the flat, so I was locked in. So apologies for being late. I know it's disrespectful. Chairperson, I just wanted to... my colleague is quite correct. We are broadly in agreement with the bill. We think it's the right thing to do and the right way to go. But when I look at the comments and responses in the document that we're going to look at now, the one aspect that doesn't seem to be emphasized is the question of companies who submit claims on behalf of members of the public or contributors. And my mind is not yet made up on that particular issue. And I wonder if the Minister wanted to comment on that. There's two different views of it, and I'm undecided whether we should stop somebody being allowed to submit the claim on behalf of a claimant, and what the reason for that is. It's a decision that obviously has to be taken by the department, by this committee, by Parliament, and so on. And I know the Minister's got to go, but I thought perhaps she could give us a comment on her view. I haven't made up my mind yet. My colleague seems to have made up his mind, but I'm unsure. We did get some submissions from organizations saying they do that work. And there's two different views. The one is you shouldn't take money away from an unemployed person to pay a fee to do that service. But the other view is, should we stop an unemployed person who wants to seek the assistance of somebody to help them? There are two different arguments, and I'm not sure that's the Minister has a last comment before she leaves, but I won't delay you.
Let's give you, Minister, that opportunity, seeing that the leader of the opposition has apologized and being late. Just at least to hear something from you, let's give him that opportunity.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, we were discouraging that precisely because the contributor only claims based on the credits that he or she has in the fund. Because what is happening is that the contributor contributes and the employer contributes 1%, both of them. So, and also what you are doing as the Department of Labor through UIF, we are doing these services for free, and we have even allowed a situation where a member can claim online. Now, the challenge that from the experience of what is happening in the compensation fund, we are avoiding exactly that. And for the present moment, even we agree with all people at MetLab, all constituencies, both business, organized labor, and community and government, that we should not allow or we should discourage people who are going to be in between the person who is a contributor who is making a claim and also the unemployment insurance. Because in most cases, when you look at those cases, people are claiming a lot of money for really doing nothing, I must say. Because if immediately, for example, the services that we are doing in the unemployment insurance is that if a person comes and submits a claim, immediately after a day or two, that person will get a direct communication to say you are processing your claim, it has reached us, and therefore we want all the details for that particular person, and then we will pay directly that particular person. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Minister. I think now that there are no hands, as you have said, Honorable Oli, this will be debated further as the department will be presenting. We really thank you so much for honoring the invitation despite your busy schedule, so you are allowed to go and attend the economic cluster. Department can take it.
Give you 3 minutes. You ready? You want some few minutes? 3, 4, okay. You can call the guys.
I have witnessed that in the way that I'm going to be can help, they can vacate only one person.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
over to you, Tichy.
Thank you very much, Honorable Shepherdson, and good morning to the Honorable members. As the Minister has already touched on a number of things,
can you please the introduction?
I was going to let Ms. Shepherdson introduce the delegation. Next to me is Mr. Bua Serue, who is the UIF commissioner. And next to Mr. Serue is the PLO for the department, Matapelo. And next to her is our legal representative, Advocate Patella. Just behind Advocate Patella is Mr. Nyekemba, who's the PLO of the ministry. What's the name? Yeah, Mr. Butelezi Makosonge from the Unemployment Insurance Fund. William Mukhashwe from the fund as well. Advocate Pasha from the department. Mr. Temkosi Mukaliti from LTA and IR. The DBC Labour Market Policy, Mr. Rachel Sheffield. Advocate Malcolm Ndeji from the teacher's office. Next to him is Mr. Mzugisi Ndaka from the Deputy Minister's office. And next to him is Mr. Nochikila from the Deputy Minister's office. And the last person next to him is Mr. Gregory Schneeman, who is the Chief of Staff in the Minister's office. Thank you, Chairperson. As indicated earlier on, the Minister has touched on the background and the few issues relating to the UIF amendment bill. As the Honourable Members would recall, that this bill has been processed in Parliament, has been processed at NEDLAC, and it came to the committee at some time in the last, in 2014-15, before it lapsed, so it had to go back and follow the established process in terms of how bills are processed. We then, in line with the established process, had to have public hearings, which were held on the 3rd of February. And the bill was presented, a number of stakeholders were invited, and comments were made by the stakeholders. So we want to deal with these comments, Chairperson, in two ways. We have actually categorized them into two classes. One, the general comments made on the bill in terms of taking the bill forward from now up until it's promulgated as the act. The second one are comments made on matters that are to be considered for future amendments. I think the Minister has touched on briefly on these issues. The constituencies that were represented during the public hearing as indicated on the screen, COSATU, the Cape Chamber of Commerce, CONSAU, NAPTU, PEDUSA, MyClay, NAIT, SATSAU, and NUMSA. One of the, let me start the question by saying we received quite a number of comments, and what we tried to do was to put together those comments that are similar in nature and respond on those comments. So we may not have
responded to each and every comment because some of them were similar. One of the comments made on the bill was that the amendment of Section 24.7, 12.10.7, the subsection 5 does not apply to a contributor who voluntarily terminated their pregnancy. Most of submissions objected to the insertion of this clause, since voluntary termination of pregnancy is regulated by Termination of Pregnancy Act, Act 1 of 2008, and not by UI Act. Our response to that is that the department does not want to regulate the termination of pregnancy aspect, but we are trying to clarify the application of the prior provision, which you will find in subsection 5 in the same section. This must not be viewed as introduction of new requirements. The second comment that we'd like to deal with, Chairperson, is relates to the PIC. In reference to the PIC, the submission may add the UIF with the PIC to enter into progressive investments, which will be able to stimulate the economy. Our response to that is that the department welcomes the proposal, but wish to indicate that the PIC and IGC are already carrying this mandate by investing in agricultural sector as an example. As part of the legal requirement, Chairperson and the honorable members, the UIF is allowed to take a portion of its contributions and invest those portions to the PIC and also buy government bonds that are listed at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. So it's part of the investment strategy of the Unemployment Insurance Fund. The third comment, Chairperson, is on the appointment of regional appeals committee by the UIF board. The concerns raised here are that the board is advisory and cannot appoint committee members. This may also erode checks and balances. Our response is that the members of the appeals committee are nominated by their constituencies, who are members of the labor federations, community constituencies, business and government. Therefore, their appointment can still be finalized by the minister since this does not change their operations. The fourth comment is the omission of graduates in the definition of unemployed. The UIF is a contributory insurance that covers employees who contributed during their employment, and graduates are unemployed subsequent to their completion of their studies, and therefore they do not qualify to receive benefits. The fifth comment is a proposal for benefits to be paid at the rate of 100% of the total loss of earnings, and the one requiring death benefits to be paid to the beneficiary for lifetime. Our response here, Chairperson, is that the UIF determines the rate of payment after receiving advice from the fund actuary. The fund always guards against its solvency. Paying 100% may be detrimental in the long run. The same principle applies to the proposal to pay death benefits for lifetime. The current proposal was evaluated and report submitted by the actuaries. The point we're trying to make it is that we need to make sure that the UIF stays solvent all the time so that it can meet its future liabilities and obligations. And the members will remember that at some point the fund was in the red and it had to take drastic steps, including the issue relating to resignation, to make sure that it remains true to its objective of being a temporary, providing temporary relief to those who have lost income. The comment number six, the submission for 4-year cycle to be reviewed since it denies benefits to employees. Our response is that the 4-year cycle is reviewed in clause 6
amendment to Section 13, wherein a new clause is inserted allowing for payment of penalties as long as there are credits. Comment number 7, amendment to Section 33, wherein the UIF bars payments for services offered. I think that's the question that the Honourable Olive raised. The Minister responded to the question. The services offered by UIF are free, and therefore no one should be charged for this service. The establishment and operation of agencies offering UIF services is discouraged. The labor unions of federations have supported this proposal. We're not saying anywhere here that people may not start their own businesses. They may. But we think that it's unfair for people to charge complainants for simply forwarding their complaints to the Department of Labor or UIF. And I think this may feed to the vulnerability, or this may exacerbate the vulnerability of the UIF beneficiaries. So that's why we're discouraging this. Domestic workers must be paid more benefits than other workers. We have the view that the benefits are paid according to a sliding scale of 38 to 60% of the earnings. People earning less are paid at a higher rate than those earning more. Therefore, domestic workers are also benefiting from the current dispensation. So the response covers that wish that domestic workers must be paid more. Comment number 9, requests for the inclusion of short-term workers. They are already covered in the bill. This is already included in the bill in clause 5. The amendment of section 12 covers this. Comment on the bill number 10, the submission to cover fixed-term employees and seasonal employees. The two categories are already covered. Like any other employee, they apply for benefits upon loss of employment. Comment number 11, the exclusion of parents who adopt children. The adoption benefits are already covered in the Act under Section 27. The only challenge is that the application can only be processed after receipt of adoption orders, which takes time to get from the Department of Justice. However, benefits are paid for full period of leave. Comment number 12, amendment of section 11.1, wherein the minister may designate any employee of the Department of Labor or UIF as accounting officer. This is aimed at allowing the accounting authority to designate individuals to focus on the fund only and address challenges without distraction from other responsibilities of the department. The commissioner runs the day-to-day activities of the fund. It's impossible that the accounting authority can be there all the time. Inclusion of small business and taxi drivers. Every person employed, regardless of the magnitude of the business, must be registered by the employer. Those employed in the small business and taxi industry qualify for benefits as they are already covered. We then come to category number 2, Chairperson, which deals with comments and responses on the matters to be considered for future amendments. One of those matters relates to the proposal on the inclusion of resignations, paternity leave, and those informal sectors, some of the issues to be considered. And similarly, surrogacy should also be considered. As outlined by the Minister, it was agreed at NetNet during negotiations that the parties will meet 18 months after the promulgation of the bill to consider other possible amendments. And all the proposals will also be subjected to actuarial evaluation so that we can look at the actual affordability. Whether if we implement this amendment 18 months from now, whether they will have any negative impact on the liquidity of the fund. Those are the comments, Chairperson, and the honourable members that we received during the public hearing. It pleases the department to note that almost 99.9% of the people that attended the public hearing supported the bill and its objectives. And it was only a handful who raised the issue relating to third-party dealings between the UIF and the claimants. And I think that's the matter that we raised and we responded to during my presentation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Patrick. I think before I allow space for comments and questions, we have Mr. Haula. He has been in the committee before. He's a new member of the committee, though. He is replacing Honorable Montega from the EFF. So that's a new member. Honorable Haula, this is the DG, and he's Anchorage from the Department of Labor. They are taking us through, as you are hearing, from what they received through the public hearings and about the amendments themselves. I'm only doing this because you are new, and I could see that you are still new to it, but after some time, you are welcome. Members, Honorable Olive, Honorable Buffery, any other hand? Honorable Olive, in that order, please.
Your person always lets me go first in case I say something naughty.
And Lord, you are good for you.
It feels better. Thank you for coming and thank you for doing the presentation. This is an enormous team, but it's an important bill, so thank you. And yes, I want to reiterate that we're generally supportive of these amendments. We think that it's better to provide the best service you can to an unemployed person. We've got a massive unemployment problem, and I think we're supportive of that. My only question goes back to this issue, and I just want to ask a couple of follow-ons to this issue, because there's a question of principles, and there are two principles here that clash. And when there are two principles that clash, you've got to try to, as a politician, see what is going to be the best. The one principle is to prevent unsuspecting workers from being charged large fees for something which they could do themselves. That's the one danger. And we wouldn't certainly like to see people being exploited. So that's the one danger. The other danger is that we prevent free choice. And you know, that's what legislators do. We always stop people from making certain choices because we think we know better than them. And both of those are dangers here on this issue. It's the only controversial part of these amendments. I think the rest of it, you're going to see all the parties just say yes to. So this is the one little niggle, and I just want to think it through clearly before I make up my mind. I agree, and my colleague Mr. Bagger pointed out to me that the claimant is not going to get any more money if they pay a service provider to submit their claim. So they're not going to increase their benefit, which is why I'm inclined to want to support your view. increased benefits because the service provider could somehow present a better case, then that might be different. So I'm not sure I entirely agree with doing that in the compensation fund space or in the road accident fund space. Because if you are not knowledgeable about the law and about your rights in a complicated application, you may be disadvantaged because you don't really know how to claim. Do I claim for pain and suffering, or can I only claim for medical benefits, or can I only claim for... It's complicated. It seems to me this is more simple. So I'm inclined to favour your view. But I am then, as a legislator, together with other committee members, saying, but we're not going to give you the choice, which says to the claimant, we know better than you. We're not going to let you have that choice. If you want to pay somebody 500 rand to submit your forms for you and follow up on that claim, we're not going to allow it. And the reason I say that is because it's not really true to say you're not trying to stop these businesses. By saying they can't charge a fee, there is no possible way you can run a business and pay for the tea and coffee in your office if you can't charge a fee. So essentially we're shutting down these businesses. I'm thinking about just the audit. I'm not saying we mustn't. I'm sort of leaning in your direction, but I'm still worried that we create red tape and we block people's choices every time we legislate. And this is one of those cases where we have to make, I think, a difficult decision, where we have to say, should we stop these people from exercising their choice? If the UIF and the compensation fund had a squeaky clean record, that there was CD, that the Department of Labor's offices around the country were efficient, that we didn't see long queues, that we didn't see people coming back 4 months in a row and their papers were lost, then I would probably just say yes to your view. But because I know the system bogged down and these poor people suffer for months because the paperwork is a problem, my question to you is, why should we, in that situation where there is such problems with, I mean, you see the emails we sent every so often when they come to us and say, hey, this Kempton Park office, they don't want to help me or whatever. In that environment where I think everyone in this room has said at some point there are difficulties with the compensation fund, I think that's acknowledged by everybody. I won't say how bad or whatever, but there's problems. We also found problems with the UIF fund, and those problems are partly linked with the local labour office. Sometimes, for example, Mr. Sirue, your computer system goes down twice a week. I went to visit the Randburg Labor Office in January and to see. And twice a week, the computer system goes down and the people who are sitting there can't be helped. Another one of the labor offices, the guy sacked from 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock. I think it was the Kempton Park office. And at 4 o'clock, the manager of that office locks the door, and if you're still sitting in a queue, he tells you you must leave and come back another day. Now, I'm not telling stories. I went to those offices. If you look at the newspaper reports, when the media followed me, you can see I was there. There's a photograph of me standing there. I talked to actual members of the public. So in that environment, is it wise for us to legislate against those members of the public getting help from a service provider? I'm putting that question. That is the difficult question. That's my job, and I have to make that decision. Is it or isn't it? And as I say, if there was very good service from all labor offices in the country, from all, and the computer system didn't go off twice a week at the Randburg office, I would say, yeah, all right, these people are necessary. But if you are one of those people, members of the public, and you go and you sit 4 hours, and you sit another day 4 hours, and then you come back a month later to try and process the system so you can get your first month claim, and they've lost your papers, are these little companies that charge, I don't know what they charge, but are they the devil if they're trying to help those people who are struggling to get their claim processed? So I just put that to you. It is complicated, and I think you'll agree with me, there's no perfect answer. So I just want to hear you convince me a little bit more that it is the right thing to do to stop those people from using a service provider. It's a moral question. It's not a technical question. assisting someone, helping someone who's struggling. I just want to hear a bit more than just labor support. Does business support it? For example, we went at MedLink. Was it only labor that supported that amendment at MedLink, or was there, were there other comments? Did the social group support it? Did business support it? Was there anyone at the speed? Sorry, I'm making a little bit of a long question. Please forgive me, but for me it's the only thing in this bill that, that really matters to me. The rest of the bill I don't have any comments on. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of comments. First of all, the comments that people have made about the PIC and the investments, I think they're trying to look beyond the mandate of the UIF, and it shouldn't really be of too much concern for us, and I wouldn't worry about that too much, because people obviously are looking beyond the mandate. It's not your mandate to run the PIC. Just in terms of the appeals, and I'm going in the order that you made your comments, in terms of the appeals and the nominated constituency and putting together appeals, I want to mix that with the representation, because at the appeal process, one might have some value in being represented by someone. And I'm not sure if you put your mind to that. And that's just tagging on to what Honourable Hollis had to say. In terms of payment of 100% of the rate, you said it's probably not sustainable in terms of the actuaries. One also, there's another issue, one also doesn't want to encourage people to leave their employer. And I think if you're getting at 100% of your rate, there'd be a great encouragement. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of collusion between business and employees, where you collude to actually create a situation where you've been dismissed, so you've flagged your UIF. And I'm sure you are aware of it. I know I'm very aware of it, because people approach me all the time. And the business is to say, well, we can retrench everyone, and then they can collect their UIF. And making 100%, you're probably encouraging people to lose their jobs, which is exactly the opposite of the front end in this country. In terms of the core business of the UIF, one needs to stick to the knitting. That's your services. Your services of the UIF is very different to any other insurance. And the whole idea about UIF is to give you protection in case you lose your job unwittingly. Sometimes through fault of your own, you might have stolen the petty cash and you lose your job, but that's why you're taking insurance. And that's what it is. We must go back to the insurance idea of it. And in terms of the services that Honourable Hollis was talking about, this is very different to motor accidents, where if you get good advice, you might get a lot more. He's absolutely right. You can only get what you're supposed to get. A service provider can't get you more. What I'd like to appeal to you is, and use the example of the CCMA, where they have an actual help desk, where you go in. Member of the public, I'm Joseph. I go into the CCMA, I go to the help desk, and they fill in the forms for me. And they do a fantastic job. I've got to tell you that. The department has done a fantastic job with the CCMA, where you don't make mistakes, you do it properly, it's efficient, it works well, and maybe that will cure what Honourable Hollis is at to say. We could have help desks at each, and you'd have to train your staff. Unfortunately, it's quite heavy training, but I think we have the time and the ability to do that, because you've shown you've been able to do it with the CCMA, and what about here? And more people use the UIF than the CCMA, so it's probably worthwhile. In terms of domestic workers, it is an issue, and I tell you why it's an issue, is it's education. And I'm not sure how you can reach out to that sector, which is probably the most downtrodden of any sector, and domestic workers tend to lose their jobs more often than most, because they get abused. And they need to be educated that they can actually access the UIF. The real problem with domestic workers is that the majority of domestic workers aren't registered for UIF. That's the real problem. And there we need to knock the employers on the head very strongly, which will lead me to the point about inspectors. We need more inspectors at the department and better qualified inspectors. And I'll tell you why, because it's almost impossible to get to each household. That's impossible. But you could have an inspection, you go to one flat and a block of flats, and you catch one employer over there, that message will go across to every single one else. Just take the Atlantic Seaboard, for instance, here in Cape Town. I'm sure if you send one inspector to one block of flats and inspect three flats, you find someone is not registered, and that message from the bush telephone in the Atlantic Seaboard would get to everyone. There'd be complete panic, and I think it's about time we send an inspector to a flat. Can you imagine what that would do? And I think it would be great. Which it talks the same for small businesses. Because I can tell you now that I can pick out 100 small businesses and I'll find 50 that are not registered at all. For nothing. Not for workers' compensation, UIF, probably not PAYE either, or anything of that nature. We need more inspectors. And I'm desperately begging for you to put more money in the budget for that, for the inspectors. In terms of your last point about the 18 months, I think that's absolutely vital. We mustn't miss that. Because we come from a history where the UIF was bankrupt. We're very fat now. And it's nice to live in the years of plenty for UIF. But it takes a very small change and we'll be in the years of famine. I don't want to be like Joseph and predict that we're going to live through the famine. But now that we are fat, let's make sure that we protect that fat. So I would not, in fact, that last sentence, all the proposals would be subjected to actuarial. I would say not subjective, but subject to actuarial. In other words, leave the ED out. Because subject to, in other words, let that actuarial qualification have more power. Because if the actuaries say you're going to be bankrupt next year, then gee whiz, we must step back because your core business that I started off with is the insurance, the eye of the UIF. Thank you, Madam Chair, I appreciate it. But we do support this amendment very strongly.
Thank you, Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we are prepared. I'm viewing these amendments as coming as a breath of fresh air to the people of South Africa. But coming to what Honourable Onis has raised, I just want to lobby him to say, let's agree that the use of a middle person may not bring the desired outcome. Because when you look at the funding that is paid for UIF, those are not huge amounts. They may be claiming to pay the middle person and they are left with nothing. Whereas UIF is meant to make a difference while the person is not getting paid. I just want to draw the attention of all of us here to how desperate sometimes these middle people are. There's an advert, for instance, that is running over the radio where it is saying for those who were employed in the health department, if you are not paid what is due to you, come to us, we'll claim on your behalf. If they go to the extent of advertising their services to assist people, it means they are desperate. And let us not allow them to grab from the hands of our people the little that they can get. It should make a difference in terms of their life. But having said that, I want to join my colleagues in saying, polish your act as a department so that the claim period is adhered to. People should not continuously go there without being given what is due to them. There are vendors, for instance, that say, for instance, a person has claimed and credits the person has are saying a person is supposed to be paid for 4 months. Then the person is paid once, the money does not come again. So the stop and go should not be done. Everything that is due to a person should be given to that particular person. As I land, Chair, I want to say, as the African National Congress also, we are joining our colleagues to say these amendments are a sigh of relief. We support the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Bruno. Honourable America.
Good morning, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Lamati and your delegation. My question is regarding the voluntary termination of pregnancy, and such a contributor would not qualify for any benefits. Now, there may be, well, one could broadly just agree with it, yeah, but there may be exceptional circumstances where a pregnant person may, for various reasons, have contracted I wouldn't say a disease, or perhaps, you know, later pregnancy is discovered through tests that the pregnancy poses substantial risk to the fetus or to the parents, but the option is then left to the parent to decide whether he or she should continue with the pregnancy. And upon the decision that the parent may decide to terminate, would be classified as voluntary, and that contributor would be excluded. Alternatively, also perhaps due to death, the bottom line, Madam Chair, is that there may be instances, you know, which would be medically supported, that the risk of continuing with the pregnancy would have negative consequences for the child or the parent, and the option is left to the family or the parent to decide what he or she wishes to do with regard to that pregnancy. And perhaps we need to consider that, and because it may be exceptional circumstances. And lastly, Madam Chair, is that the inclusion of public servants in terms of benefits, and it is stated that there are no real financial implications for the fund, but it is further stated that the government reimburses the actual expenses paid as benefits to those public servants who make use of the fund. I don't quite understand that. It just provides little clarity, as to what is meant by that particular phrase. Thank you, ma'am.
Over to you, TC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask my colleagues to deal with some of the questions. I want to start by saying we really do appreciate the support that the bill is getting from all the members. The second point I would like to talk to is the issue raised by Honorable Olives on this issue of the middleman or the middle person. I think one of the reasons that really motivated us to put this provision in the amendment is that you currently have, if you are complaining, you currently have a legal recourse. You can go to the institution, what we call them, the Section 9 institutions. You can go to the Office of the Public Protector, you can go to the Human Rights Commission to complain about the poor service that you're getting from a department. So you already have those in place. You don't pay a cent when you go to the Office of the Public Protector. You don't pay a cent when you go to Human Rights Commission. Now, if we allow, I hear the point you're raising of presenting a free choice. We're not saying they mustn't go there. They can. But we have no obligation to go to that institution or to that company and say to them, this is how far we are with the case. Because our relationship is with the claimant, not the company or the middle person. So the challenge that we're experiencing now is that these companies, they are of the view that we should account to them. And we say we shouldn't account to them, we account to the complainant. Now, that's why we felt that we need to clarify the relationship that we should have with whoever would be providing, you know, sort of an assistance to a claimant. I think that's what prompted us. We are in no way preventing them from accessing them. They may, if they have the necessary resources, but we stressing the point that this is a free service. I think that Honorable Bakbain addressed the issue of the PIC, which I think we agree with. I'll ask the commissioner to deal with the issue of the appeals and whether we should have representations, you know, during the proceedings. I think we agree with you on the mandate of the UIF that we always make sure that we keep it in mind that this is why the UIF exists. We shouldn't do anything that is outside of mandate of the Unemployment Insurance Fund. We really take the advice on the establishment of a health desk. I think we'll look at it, Chairperson, and in an attempt to try and improve the services and also reduce, you know, long lines, because I think some of the people, they just want the form. So you give them the form, off they go. I think we are in a process of trying to change the way we do things as well. The issue of domestic workers is a very difficult one. As you have rightly pointed out, Honorable Bahrain, the difficulty with this is that it's the nature of the relationship that domestic worker has with the employer, because sometimes it tends to be a very sort of a paternalistic kind of a relationship. You know that your employer is not complying with the law, but the only time that you are prepared to share that information with the Department of Labor is when your relationship is not as good as it was. Then you share that information. But voluntarily, it's a difficult one. I can assure you that we do go to flats on a regular basis and try and catch people out. I think that's the only way that seems to work. But the other difficulty that we have is that constitutionally, a private household is not regarded as a workplace. I think we're sitting with that. I think Mr. Mkalibe and Mr. Fairfield can attest to that. Whether by the fact that now you have a law that regulates employment conditions, whether by virtue of that you have translated a household into a workplace, it's up for a legal, you know, challenge. But we treat a household as if it's a workplace. That's why we spend our inspectors there. But it's something that has been thrown at us from time to time. We really appreciate the call for a need to have more inspectors. We hope that Sona will say, the budget for speech today will help us to realize that. The Honorable Lonewen, I think we take the point that we need to polish our act as a department. We're trying our level best to see to it that we improve the way we we do things. We're currently in the process of reviewing our, you know, our service, to our services throughout the country, and we're hoping that that will yield positive results. On the termination, I'll ask the commissioner and the legal people to assist us with that. But my layman understanding is that that's why you have the appeals board. In exceptional cases where there's medical proof that termination was as a result of an advice from a medical practitioner, and that if you keep this pregnancy, it may have adverse health implications, I think that that can be considered, and the UI F commissioner and the appeals committee, I think that would favorably look at that situation. I think it's the same way with the resignation, because in the resignation matter, if it can be proven that you have been constructively dismissed, then the UIS is obliged to, you know, to give you the benefits. But it has to be proven. That's why you have to go to the CCMA and have a case of a constructive dismissal. Commissioner.
Thank you, GC, and good morning, members. Just to deal with the first issue, GC, about the agencies. I think we take the advice that we did have problems in terms of our IT systems, and the reason is the investment, and we will. I think we're in the process of investing in the infrastructure, because the more you have more people, the more your infrastructure is actually overburdened. So already the processes are in place to invest in the infrastructure. And as the DG has indicated, we're also trying to have the CSOs, Mr. Ollis, who are going to focus on the UI, to be licensed officials. Because currently we have people who look into all the services, and we believe that would address the issue that Mr. Ollis and also Ms. Lolly has actually put forward. The issue of the assisting people, we actually welcome that. The only thing that we say is that the money that we pay to workers, vulnerable workers, is not much. So the only thing that we are against is the issue of payment. So when a worker or a claimant has got a problem with the UI, there's a process where there's an appeal. But one of the things that are quite important is that our appeal committee is very objective. It was not coming from the official. It's coming from labor, business, and constituency. But if, for instance, people want to assist, they can, but the issue is the issue of money that has to be paid to them. The issue about reinvestment is what we are saying here is that instead of government contributing to the UIF, that is the process that we waive, because government, because the financial implications to government will be too much. But then the decision is that if, for instance, a worker loses their work and they qualify for the UIF will pay the worker. Government will reinvest. We're already doing that with the compensation fund, where government brings a certain amount of money, but it doesn't contribute directly per employee. So that is the process. I think it is because we try to be reasonable to the fiscal. I'll ask Advocate Pachela to deal with the issue of voluntary termination.
Thank you, Chair. I think we must indicate that when we put the provision, we were not trying to regulate the termination of pregnancy aspect. It was just a qualification to say the miscarriage benefits will not be paid to people who voluntarily terminate their pregnancy. But the concerns that have been raised in relation to exceptional circumstances that like illnesses, this will be covered by instances wherein doctors will file in their medical certificate to say these are the circumstances that this pregnancy was terminated. And if they are related to illnesses, we also cover for or offer illness benefits. So even if this person doesn't qualify for maternity benefits in line with the termination, this person might also still be covered to receive illness benefits, because this person will have medical certificate to say this person was unable to report for duty for this number of days due to a particular illness. Then even illness benefits will be catered for in this instance. So I think it's not our intention to regulate the issue relating to termination of pregnancy. That's why even in our report, we said this matter is regulated in the Termination of Pregnancy, the Pregnancy Act. So it was just a clarification of on the miscarriage provision that was put in the Act. If I may add on the issue relating to appeals, we would welcome the representation, but the current dispensation is done on paper. They file their appeals on paper and they are submitted via to the regional appeals board, the national appeals board. The benefits, the employees themselves don't appear in person. The appeal board deals with their appeals on paper. So even assistance in filling the correct papers, our CSOs at the regional offices tries to assist them in completing the forms in correctly and make sure that all the documentation required are there. So the dispensation might not allow for certain people coming in person as it's still done on documentation that are filed through. I think that's all.
I think we've covered all the questions.
Thank you, the clarity that our advocate, Mr. Roda, is a parliamentary advocate for the community. There's a clarity that he's seeking from you. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just have a further concern also about the choice of termination of pregnancy, because it doesn't only come down to illness or life-threatening illnesses to the mother or to the fetus. My concern is in instances of rape or in instances of affordability of the baby or single parents in those circumstances. I fear that, my fear is that by telling a woman what to do with her own body, we're infringing and discriminating on her a little, or not a little, we're discriminating. It could amount to discrimination. That's my only concern there. So maybe there's a way, and together with the drafting department and parliament, we could look at maybe working that section, because that's my only, it could amount to discrimination. I'm not a court, so I can't say it is discrimination. But it could amount to discrimination on one of the categories listed in the Constitution. So that's my concern. We can work around coming up with an amendment to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Joseph.
Related to that, could I just respond? Madam Chair, this is related to... Sorry, ma'am.
I did not point you. Are you doing a follow-up on the question that you have asked? Okay, there's a new question as well.
So I'll allow your two follow-up questions and the new question that will be coming from the member from the FL.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is a responsive advocate, and Miles one could agree with the explanation. As it is written in the law, it does not, because we're dealing with vulnerable employees, people who will not interpret the clause as it's been explained with its broad intentions. So, in terms of, we need to look at that, perhaps redraft it and incorporate the concerns that's been raised by the advocate as well in front. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks. Just to follow up in terms of the comment about the private household, I strongly disagree, and let me explain why. There are thousands and thousands of businesses which are home-based businesses, and there's two things that arise out of that. First of all, the labor laws trump all other laws, other than the Constitution, of course, but the labor laws have trumped the other than. But the second thing is, when I run a business in my house, I claim income tax relief from running that business in my house. So in fact, I'm declaring to the receiver of revenue that this is a business. Now I know that domestic workers don't do that, and you don't claim your relief from that business in terms of that, but it's still employment. And if you read the Labor Relations Act, that's still an employment relationship. You have all the rights that any other employee has when you work in a private household. And if those rights are that you're entitled to an inspector coming to investigate your working circumstances, then you're entitled to it. Can you imagine if I, as a homeowner, are locking an inspector out of my house because the domestic workers complained that you've been forced to work 14 hours a day? You've got to look at it in that context. I don't believe that your inspector can be held out of that house. Yes, you might have a problem if the homeowner won't let you in, but I believe any court would allow you to go in there because you've got to trump that. So I just wanted to make that comment. I think it would be tantamount to breaching the whole Labor Relations Act if you just say, no, you're not allowed. I know I've got a factory in my garage of 15 workers sewing, but you can't come here as a private household. Can you imagine that? I mean, your inspector would hit the roof. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kaula. Thank you, Honorable Professor.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, mine is short. It's just a clarity. But also from the purpose of the act. But I think that it refers to, which is basically welcome, extension of scope to learner. And I just want to check the interpretation of learner. I once worked for a teacher for some years. I understand that learners could be brought. I just want to check if it does include intern, experiential learners, apprentices, because those will fall into the category of learners, or that specifically limit itself to people that are engaged in learners. I just want the clarity. The other part that I want to, which basically I'm left with the response of the department with regard to the service providers that want to charge for the fee. I know for a fact that my experience working for a theater is that consultancies will go out of their way to look for work. So if you were to allow consultancies to charge, you will actually find that they will even be bringing more problems than solutions, because they will go out, look for employment, even to people that may not necessarily qualify. So I welcome the fact that consultants should not be allowed to charge the fee, it's going to be a problem. But I think the general goodness of the act is only clouded by whilst you are saying that your intention is not to regulate pregnancy, in a way you will be indirectly regulating it. I want to submit that it would be better that you leave the part that says that voluntary termination should be excluded, because it will create problems than solutions. And in fact, I don't think it will fly consistently to the spirit and the purpose of the act. So I want to advise that, because in my view, it imposes moral standards. People should have a right and an option to decide whether they can keep their pregnancy or not, without necessarily fearing the implications of the act. So I'm just saying that while you are saying that you are not intending to regulate pregnancy, but in a way you are. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the honourable members. I think on the issue of the voluntary termination of pregnancy, we will take the advice of the legal counsel, as he has eloquently put it. We will therefore, you know, we stand to be advised by the legal people on how best to phrase this, whether it is advisable, as the Honorable Kaula has mentioned, to drop it in its entirety, or we include it but in a manner that is not seen to be infringing on the constitutionality of the act, and also without passing moral judgment on people. So we'll leave that to the legal people to advise us. On the on whether a household is a workplace, I think Mr. Kalibu wants to have a bite on that.
Thank you. I think there's no question that the LRA deals with the issue of the workplace, and the recent amendment indicates that the workplace is where you work, trying to deal with the issue of the labor broking that is resulting that workers work in Fahrenheit. Therefore, their workplace is not resulting, although their employer is resulting, their workplace is where they work. The same applies in the domestic sector. The workplace of the employees is where they work. The issue here is access. And the legislation does not, the access is dealt with in terms of the constitution, in terms of safety, in terms of protection, and all of those issues. Because this is not like any other company, it's private residence, it becomes very difficult. And the DCA, in fact, makes it clear that inspectors don't have automatic access in this. They've got to make arrangements to access the domestic arrangements. And such the difficulty making those arrangements, the employers themselves in this are employees, they work somewhere else, employers themselves. And that's where the problem is. The problem is not about whether it's a workplace or not. It is a workplace. But the problem is accessing that workplace at the time that inspectors are going to do their job. That's where the tricky part is. And then with all other legislation that come into that, that are not necessarily labor legislation. Thank you.
Do you want to talk on that issue or general? Okay. If we wait, if that one. No, then Honorable Lolly.
No, sir, I just wanted to give hope to committee members that there's another round coming where we'll be discussing the bill clause by clause. So some of this debate will be carried through at that stage. But it's good that there's going to be this session between the legal advisor of parliament and the department, so that at least by that time there's a concrete proposal so that we can interact with it at that stage. Thank you.
Honorable, thank you, Member. Honorable America.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the clause dealing with a deceased contributor, where if there is no surviving spouse or children or whatever, then a nominated beneficiary can claim benefits. Now, as it is very sort of unclear as to who can be classified as a nominated beneficiary. Would that be a person identified in the will of a deceased estate? Because we know many of our people don't have wills. You know, it's an endless problem, you know, for our people when they die and there's no will. So how are we going to identify who a nominated beneficiary would be? Somebody just come forward and say, well, that's my uncle, I'm his nominated beneficiary, and therefore I qualify to claim their benefits. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. The Commissioner will respond to the two questions on the Lena provisions and also the one on the who's classified as a nominated beneficiary.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of learnership, we include people who are working, who want to get experience at work, and also those who are taken on internships and those who are on learnership, because previously they were excluded. And we know that most of the time, these are the people who end up being employed at work. So learnership includes all those categories. The issue of what we're trying to address here, honorable members, is an issue where people forfeit their benefits. For instance, the act is clear that if a worker dies, the beneficiary will be the spouse. If there's no spouse, it will be the children. But if there are no children, the money is forfeited. So what we are trying to address is the issue where we know that maybe the worker was responsible for other people. So we are trying to bring this particular provision to help the workers. Now, the way we are going to do it is that if there's no one who qualifies, the worker will have to nominate. So our cue will be taken from the worker, giving us a person who will benefit. But that particular person is not going to take precedence over the normal beneficiaries to qualify. Only if these categories are absent, it's only then we say give us the nomination. But we're not going to give preference to a person who has been chosen over the beneficiaries of the work.
Thank you, sir. It's more like a will, sort of. We're saying in advance, in the event that you pass on and you do not have keys, or who would you nominate? So that information is kept in the file, and so when that time comes, we just retrieve the file and we process the case.
Thank you, Deputy. Let's go back to the question of access to the workplace, Mr. Furuwe. Mr. Furuwe, are you implying that there are workplaces where workers are abused, and because it is difficult to enter the discharge check office, the Department of Labor, because it's the access, the question of access does not only arise on private houses. Yes, there are workplaces, these are the workers of the workplaces. So the law that applies to the fully-fledged company should be applying on these private houses. So what is this difficult?
Chair, the difficulty, or let me start by saying, firstly, we agree that all the legal provisions that you have in the different pieces of legislation that you administer are applicable. But the difficulty is that when it comes to access, inspectors cannot rock up just like any other normal workplace and do an inspection. For instance, I think Mkalip made a point about the fact that even the Basic Conditions of Employment Act does not in any way regard a private household as a workplace. And that in a way is a provision that makes life difficult for an inspector to say, in terms of a law, I can enter this workplace anytime of the day and do an inspection. However, we're not saying that we don't do anything. We go to these workplaces. Our inspectors, I mean, we have taken some domestic workers to court. We have issued the compliance orders and undertakings were made, and in instances where those undertakings were not honored, we have taken the employer to court. So it's really not a serious issue per se, but we were highlighting it because it has the potential to impact on the work of an inspector, and in fact it does impact on the work of an inspector. One of the things that we have done over the years is to send out what we call calling cards. You know, when you're going to do an inspection, we put in the boxes, post boxes of the owner of the household, a letter which says an inspector will be coming to do an inspection. Because what you don't want to do is to send an inspector there and the inspector doesn't get access, or the employer is not there because of the nature of the workplace that you're dealing with. In any other normal workplace, you rock up there, you find a representative of the employer if the employer is not there, and therefore you can do a normal inspection, you can do your work as prescribed by the law. I think that we're just highlighting that issue relating to access.
Another one. Okay. Thank you, DC. In fact, as you spoke, I remember that I remember what the problem is and where does the problem come from. And I think I know.
Thanks. Following on the chair's request about looking at this, it looks like you're treating households with maybe too much caution. And these laws were written before home industry became such a fad and such a fashion, because a lot of people who can't find employment run businesses from their homes and home industry. And again, I understand if the owner of the home is not there, but surely you have to overcome that, because otherwise the person will never let you in. And how do you allow for that? You can't. And my strong imploring attitude is that I think because it's probably the most vulnerable of the workplaces, domestics. We're making them even more vulnerable than not actually accessing the problem. And there must be a way, and maybe we need to get a court order or something to get a way forward. You need a court to tell you that you're entitled to it, because if a factory doesn't want to allow your inspector in, you actually would pretty quickly run and get a court order and you'd be in there with the deputy sheriff within minutes. I think you need to have some law backing you that you are entitled to the private household. And I think our chair's hit the nail on the head. That is a vexing problem. I'd hate to walk out of here today thinking that you're too scared to go into a private household.
Mr. Fitch.
Thank you, and good morning, colleagues. Chair, I think we are raising, effectively, if I may, with all due respect, a non-issue. Firstly, the GPA recognizes the sanctity and the privacy in terms of Section 2 of the Bill of Rights of a household. But then it also recognizes the reality that Honorable Buckland is raising. It is an inspector, there are two instances where an inspector can go into a private household. One, with the consent of the household. If the consent is not there, the labor inspector can apply in writing to the labor court. But taking the issue that you raised, by Honorable Bahrain, to say that I need access to that household. So that's provisional already in the Act that says that I can go into a household on written application for the labor court. So Section 65, Clause 2 of the Act makes provision for that reality. One is with the consent of the household. Two, if there's no consent, an inspector can enter a household with a written application to the labor court, and the labor court provides for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further indications from the department? None. I will ask the members to remain behind, even if I say the meeting is adjourned, it will be adjourned for the department. We wish to thank you, DG, the officials, for the input to make us to understand more exactly what is that we will be or we should be presenting to Parliament. But of course, we will have our own opportunity to sit down and look at it. The legal advisor will only sit with you after he has spoken with us, because we need to understand what is going to be talking to you or what arrangements are going, because it will be useless for him to go to you and then come back to us and find us not with him. So the best thing, when he goes and talks to you, we as committee members have already interacted with him so that we know exactly what is that we want out of the issues that have been raised. And thank you very much. I think it's understandable. We do understand. I think the issue of the middleman is it kind of is difficult, honorable members, to deal with it, because I do understand that we do want to make business. But I don't know how much, you know, the money that we get, people get from UIF, it's a very little amount. I hear the question of choice, as Honorable colleagues was saying, but we will discuss as the committee and then come up with a final say whether we want to phrase or it will be like that, but we will have an opportunity as a committee to discuss all the issues that we are, as members, not comfortable with, and advise you accordingly through the legal person from Parliament. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much, Chair.
We can pray for 5 minutes and allow the department to pack its stuff. It is just going to be 5 minutes as well. If I have done this 5 minutes, it won't be long. Thank you.
that's the main idea of the
Members, there is another issue on the agenda that you are left with. It's a short briefing from the committee assistant from Content Advisor and Researcher on the public hearings that we had on that day. Definitely there will be nothing much in terms of difference, because these issues that you raised in the department are the same issues, but I'm sure there were cases, there will be cases where they're going to elaborate. Let's hear from them.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Member. We have prepared the report on the public hearing, and as the chairperson has already alluded, it covers similar issues that have been already addressed by the department, except they address some of the issues, like for example, during the public hearing, the chairperson mentioned that even though the closing date for the submission, official submission, was the 8th of January, but still there was an allowance for those who still wanted to make a written submission. So subsequently we received a written submission. All of them were relating to clause 4, which seeks to amend section 11, that I'm mistaken. We were dealing with the objection to clause 18, which seeks to amend section 33, the one that deals with the prohibition to charges of any fees. Those written submissions, they appear to be, they were similar in nature, the only difference that is the change in the name and the ID number. So I've just quoted the way they are phrased, and then I'm just going to read it as it is, so that the members will have an idea of what the submissions were about. They read like, I am a South African citizen with a constitutional right to choose whether I wish to employ and pay any third party to submit a UIF claim on my behalf if I am unable to do so myself. The addition of the subsection will rob me of my right to choose, and I strongly object against this. This will also jeopardize any future claim I may need to submit, as I probably won't queue due to overcrowding and the wasted time that it takes. I also object to the fact that the proposed amendment bill would infringe on the citizen's right to choose their chief occupation or profession freely as stated in section 27 of the Bill of Rights, read with section 36 thereof. So yeah, all the submissions that were received, so they seem to have been made, I think, more in a form of repetition, like if I may say, but not like side petition. The other issue that came up during the public hearings was that the organized labor objected to some of the clauses on the basis that they were not in the bill that was discussed at NADLEC, as there was a time lag between the finalization of the NADLEC process and the bill being tabled before Parliament and referred to the committee. They are saying that there were changes made to the bill that was eventually tabled to Parliament. One of those clauses, they say, is clause 4, which deals with the delegation of functions of the accountant officer. Clause 4, it seeks to amend section 11. So they say that clause was not in the bill that was discussed at NADLEC. Another one is this well contested clause 10, which seeks to amend section 24. Dealing with the voluntary termination of pregnancy. Organized labor also said that this clause was not in the bill that was discussed at NADLEC. So they objected and were of the opinion that those two clauses have to be removed because they were not discussed at NADLEC. I think those are the issues that I think were not covered from the presentation of the department. Thank you.
Anything from you, Sim?
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think just one tiny issue that also came out to that maybe we forgot to reflect was a point that it says that the department never held public hearings on the bill before they went to MedLink. So that should usually be the process that would happen. The department holds the public hearing, then MedLink, and then Parliament. So it was just highlighted also during the public hearings that no public hearings were held on the bill, given the fact that it affects the most vulnerable who would have quite a lot to say on the bill. So, yeah. Thank you.
Members, this presentation by committee assistants reflecting on what has been communicated to us or presented to us, both in through the public hearings and in submission. Now let me start with Honorable Lolio, because it's two hands that are up to your hand and that one of Honorable Oli. Noted, Honorable Lolio.
Thank you, Chair. I welcome the input, but what I don't find in the input, what is the concluding remark of the submission that came beyond the public hearing? Are they saying, despite what they are citing, they are for or against the bill, or they are quiet on that one?
Honorable Holly.
Thanks, Chair. I hope that the officials of the committee won't tell us whether they favor the bill or not, because I think that's a political decision, not a staff decision. But anyway, my question, I have two comments.
I didn't get that through.
The first one, I just mean that I'm not sure whether I understood Honorable Lolloway's question. She seemed to be asking the officials their opinion of whether or not this is a good bill. And maybe I misunderstood. Okay, I misunderstood.
Honorable Lolio, no, allow me to finish, then you will respond on what. Do you want to clarify before you continue?
No, it doesn't matter. I'm just making the point that I don't think the officials should give us their opinion on whether or not we should support the bill. But they are quite free to make comments on the content of the bill. I'm happy for that.
Lolio, were you asking for the opinion of the officials?
No, Chair. I said the submission that came after. Wake up, my friend.
You're giving me bad coffee this morning, so I can't wake up. I just want to then just make two comments. It's a pity, Chair, that we only got those inputs after the department is gone, because now it leads to a question that only the department can answer. The question is, if those two clauses that are controversial now, that the labour organisations believe were not in the version of the bill which they got to see at NEDLAC, it means now someone has inserted those clauses off the NEDLAC. But of course now we don't know who. We can only assume the minister did it, or the department did it. But our problem now is we can't question the department because that's gone, and we can't ask them, did they insert those clauses and why did they insert those clauses? That's the first thing. The second thing is, in terms of the public hearing, I just need further clarity. Did the department do public hearings? Because the statement made by the staff was that they didn't do the public hearings before NEDLAC. So my question is, did they do public hearings after NEDLAC? Or did they do no public hearings as a department? Not us, we did our own one here. Did they do public hearings as a department at all? Or did they just do it in the wrong order? They should have done it
unless you are asking the right questions to wrong people. Because there is no one here who's got to. Do you want to speak on behalf of the department? You do. Okay, Honorable. Mr. Nyekemba, PLO from the Minister's Office, would want to answer that question. Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chairman. I think mine is on public hearing, not necessarily the clauses that are alleged they were not canvassed, etc. This bill was brought before Parliament in 2014. So before it was brought to Parliament, there were public hearings. So now, because the Parliament lies, in fact, the bill was served to the committee on the 12th of March, then it lapsed. Then it's not a new bill in the new administration. So it's a bill which has been revised just because it lapsed, of which it followed all the requirements in terms of any statute. So with the issue of hence there were no public hearings. Yeah, because what happened is it was done to reintroduce the bill to cabinet in order for cabinet to send it to Parliament. That's why the commission now is dealing with it. So there is no need, because even in the cabinet memorandum, it was stipulated that it's not a new bill, it's a bill that lasts in another administration, but all the processes before it served to Parliament in 2014 were followed. So that's the only thing that led to the bill for the department not to go for public hearing when the bill has been reintroduced. That's what I just spoke on that one, sir. On other things, the department has to respond as to why there were issues that were not discussed at NetLink but are reflected in the bill. I think the committee has its right to even in writing for that matter, suggesting that these are the issues that were blamed, they were not canvassed at NetLink. Can you clarify? The department can do that, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that clarity, Mr. Nyekemba. However, it is very strange that the labor movement would forget that process. Not that I'm saying you're wrong, because if the process were followed and then the time lapsed for the other administration, then so it means it's a continuation of what has been there. So for them to forget it is rather very strange, but thanks for the information. Honorable Ollis. Oh, sorry. You know?
Well, my question was also a follow-up to what Honorable Ollis was raising, because I want to believe that perhaps the committee should probably have a draft of whatever that could have come from NetNet, either through the department or directly from NetNet, which basically is going to verify whether there was a discussion at the level of NetNet around these two items. And if there's no evidence of that, because to me, it's a matter of principle. You see, if the labor is correct, it means the process of collective bargaining would have been compromised if we would proceed on this against that reality. But if that is not true, then it's another story. So I just want to check if the committee, either through the department or directly from NEDLAC, it could have a proof or evidence that these two plots have been tabled at the level of NEDLAC, and the neighbor is either trying to be difficult or have. But if it was never, as a matter of principle, I would also support if the matter was never discussed at that level, consistent with the collective bargaining process at national level, it would justify the argument of labor, not unless the committee can prove otherwise. Thanks. With regards to the hearing part, I will agree with you that if labor is amnesia in terms of the public hearing, it's another story. But on this one, as a matter of principle, I think that an ear should be given to the council.
Lonely Way is referring to the labor not remembering that there were public hearings before and come and claim in front of parliament that there were never public hearings. You will speak if you want to speak. I was responding not to you, but to the body language, which is not right. Honorable, let me give Honorable Fonsalve, because you had your bite before. Honorable Fonsalve.
Thank you, Chairperson. My interest is on the point raised by the content advisor on the submissions made afterwards, specifically with regards to citizens who feel that who gave their submissions, and specifically to the point that you raised that all the submissions that you received had the same wording except that the names and ID numbers differed. So my question will be, can you give us an indication of how many of these submissions that you received, and if possible you can also give an indication of the demographical areas that the submissions are coming from, so that we can indeed have an indication of what's happening there. Thank you, Chairperson.
What is that will be trying to achieve, Honorable Fonsalve, when you do that?
No, Chairperson, I just wanted to try and achieve or find out in terms of the submission. Say, for instance, it's a large number of submissions, then indeed it will weigh a lot. But also we must make sure that it is indeed original. Because, for instance, I didn't actually want to elaborate, but for instance, it might be the case that some of these submissions might be fabricated. That's all that I'm thinking, without doubting anything or anyone. But that's why I needed to know. Because if we are speaking about two or three or less than 10 submissions, it's fine. But if we are speaking about 500 or in the 100 submissions, then at least it needs to be considered appropriately. Thank you, Chairperson. But also, if we look at submissions coming from a certain demographical area, which means, say for instance, it's coming from a particular area where the addresses of those people are from a specific area or specific province, whereas or compared to if the submissions are coming from across the country, people residing across the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Lonely.
Chair, I think after the presentation you indicated that the department is better placed to respond to the queries that are raised by the input of the content advisor as a researcher. Rather than us making speculations, why don't we wait for that particular process so that as we deliberate on this particular matter, we have concrete evidence of what transpired?
Thank you, Honorable Lulwa. In fact, what we can do is to invite them when we're sitting on next week, so that before we can proceed with our own agenda of going from one clause to another, these matters would have been cleared. However, whether NEDLAC, whether it was said in NEDLAC or not said in NEDLAC, that's the only thing that you want to hear. But for us, we have an independent view at the end. Because what was agreed on NEDLAC, it does not really bind us. We will look at it, and at the end, we will come up with our own independent as members of parliament. Remember that we are not representing what NEDLAC is saying. We are looking at that. So we must bear that in mind. We can look at that process in fact. Yeah, we can look at it. And Zolanda, I think I would want to touch on this issue as well with the legal advisor immediately after this meeting, because there's something that I want to clarify. We have our own independent role. Let's not forget that one. Whether NEDLAC and Labour are saying that they said this and they did not say this, our process is here. And we're the ones who are going to say this is how we want it. So I really don't, I just want to check with the legal advisor if that process of NEDLAC and Labour, is it really something that can hold us to take decisions on going forward? Because if it's not, then we'll leave it there and then we'll continue. I'm not saying we'll not call the department. All I want to check whether when we are at that stage, it will be something that will have an effect on us to go forward. That's the only thing that I want to check. Honorable Olive.
Chair, you are quite right. NEDLAC is an advisory body to government, actually, in terms of the law. They are not a filter system. So we don't actually have to agree with NEDLAC. We can throw out everything NEDLAC says if we want to. But the point of NEDLAC is to try to consult so that we don't have big fights on the streets. We first talk. That's the point of NEDLAC. It's to try to get people on the same page. But it's not a requirement. It's something that South Africa does, obviously, to bring everybody together, and it's a good thing. My suggestion is that after you've met with a legal advisor, we draft a letter to the DG of Labour. So these 3 points were raised. Did this get added by the department after the NEDLAC process? And just give us your reasons. We are not going to be dictated by NEDLAC, but we would just like to hear the reasons before we vote, then we know what the thinking was. And he can give us a written answer. And then if any trade union says we didn't pay this into account, we've got a letter from the DG explaining the reason. So at least they can see we made one letter to resolve the issue. And then we don't need, you know, 25 people to come sit here again. Maybe just the DG can come when we debate it. We don't need, I mean, I'm just thinking of costs for the taxpayer. We can have one or two people. We don't need 25 if those are only concerns that would limit the problem. But you're right, we were not dictated to by NEDLAC. But we should at least listen to them because they've done a lot of work on our behalf.
No, thank you. In fact, what Honorable is doing is supporting what was suggested by the PLO from the Minister's Office, Mr. Nyakemba. So I think that's the route that you will take. Instead, I hear that he thinks it's one, it must be DG. You like DG? Okay, you know, that's fine. Yeah, so, on Mr. Nyakemba, we will write, that letter will be written, and then you will advise them of what the committee has said, whether they can have one or two people, but the letter as well will be fine because we'll continue. Our role on this is more of an oversight role on checking whether NEDLAC and the labor are saying the same thing. It doesn't stop us from going forward, including the issue of submission. For us, it's not about the number, it's about the content, and then we will take decisions that we want to take as a committee. Thank you. If we are done with this one, I don't think there's another thing on the agenda, so we'll be meeting then next week. One thing that must be clarified, members, after the public hearings, that we remember that initially we agreed on two public hearings in two provinces, but then we had these public hearings where we included everybody from, you know, business up to an ordinary worker from, you know, or people. So it was everybody under one roof. So I think we need a direction. Do we think that we still need more public hearing? Another colleague is shaking his. Now it's you and Ollis again. I don't know where to start now. I must start with you again, or yourself, Honorable Lolly.
Chair, I think this has been prolonged for rather too long. I want to concretely propose that now that we have held the public hearings and there was no one who was against the amendments except corrections here and there, there is no need for a second public hearing. I want to appeal to the colleagues that let's proceed with the information at our disposal. Thank you.
Honorable America.
Yeah, I have to agree with Honorable Lolly where that we dispensed with the public hearings. And I think that it's nothing new that we will hear that will influence at least my view on the amendments. Thank you.
I take it that members will agree that we are done with public hearings. We will just follow the other processes that we have to, like the next big one, where we will be looking at the clauses with the legal advisor. Anything else today? Or we have minutes? We have 4 sets of minutes that have been forwarded to you in advance. Read Zolani the first one.
Thank you, Chair. The first set of minutes, as we know, will have emanated from meetings from 2015. The last minute that was not adopted was the 28th of October 2015.
Members, so first page of those, Honorable Pascal Bates.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we've had enough time to peruse the minutes. I think yesterday's been circulated to us in advance. Hence, I would like to propose that the minutes of the 28th of October be moved as the correct version.
There's a proposal. What's up on the list? Honorable Bafrin, Honorable Zamini.
the second set. So those minutes are adopted. Second set?
Okay. The second set is Friday, 30th, October 2015.
Can we do the same as we have done with the set, same first set, since we have seen the minutes on Rapport 1?
Thank you, Chair. I look for the adoption of the minutes of the 30th October.
Adopted there, and then Honorable Buffray. Yes, sorry, Honorable America.
A second in the adoption of the minutes.
Okay, can we have someone else, Honorable Buffray? Do you want to second?
I do. Honorable Tongwana proposed that we adopt the minutes, and I second that proposal.
I'm advised that as an alternate member, when they are all here, so it should be one of them.
But none of them were at the meeting.
Well, they were not in the meeting, by the way. Yeah, okay. I think it's, oh, by the way, yes, okay. It's separate.
Thank you, Chair. The next set is the Wednesday, 4th November 2015.
4th November, Honorable Buffering. Honorable Buffering is proposing 4th November, Honorable Lollywood is seconding.
Thank you, Chair. The last set is that of the public hearing that was held on Wednesday, 3rd February 2016.
Honorable Council, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Minutes of the 3rd February. There's a proposal that must be adopted on the buffering. Seconded. Members, all the set of minutes presented in front of the committee have been adopted. And then this is the end of our meeting.
Chair, just before anybody goes, could we, either at the next committee or the following one, just have another look at the agenda for the term? There was a proposed agenda, but we're now running through it without it being approved. And we did suggest when we were called to notify that we would like to suggest one or two changes about a briefing on the compensation fund and so on.
Can we then talk about Honorable Lollywood?
Thanks, Chair. In supporting that view, I want to say let's deal with it in next week's agenda.
So it should be in the program?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Lollywood. Only that the meeting is adjourned.